men, women, and children, jostling for flour near the Damascus gate. As their numbers swelled, fighting erupted. "We have so far tolerated living without rice, sugar, and kerosene, but how can we live without bread?" In 1916, hunger turned to starvation. Locusts, war requisitioning, and hoarding, compounded by failures in the transport and distribution of food, combined to create a famine that claimed between 300,000 and 500,000 civilian lives in Syria and Lebanon between 1916 and the end of the war. In the Syrian lands, the famine and other wartime hardships came to be synonymous with the war. The population called them seferberlik, the Turkish word for general mobilization. The Great War was seferberlik, that series of misfortunes that began with general mobilization and led inexorably to crop failure, inflation, disease, famine, and death among non-combatants on an unprecedented level. A Syrian émigré on a clandestine mission for the French travelled through Syria and Lebanon in April 1916, where he witnessed the suffering at first hand. He met survivors who had fled dying villages in search of food. He found countless skeletons of victims of the famine, left unburied where they had fallen by the roadside. In conversation with a disillusioned Arab officer in Damascus, he accused the Ottomans of deliberately provoking starvation as a way to purge the state of its disloyal Christians. "They put the sword to the neck of the Armenians, as they intend to annihilate the Christian Lebanese by starvation, so that they never trouble their Turkish masters again." Enver Pasha insisted that the Allied naval blockade, imposed in the opening months of the war, was responsible for this famine. British and French vessels refused to permit any ships to enter Syrian ports, even those carrying humanitarian relief. Enver reportedly approached the Vatican in 1916 with a proposal to distribute food aid in Syria and Lebanon. Speaking to the papal envoy to Istanbul, Enver acknowledged that the Ottomans did not have enough supplies to feed both the army and the civilians in Syria. He urged the Vatican to persuade the British and French to allow at least one ship to deliver food each month, to be distributed by any agency the Pope might appoint for the task, to reassure the Allies the food would not go to Turkish soldiers. Yet nothing came of Enver's papal initiative. Like many Ottomans, Enver believed the Allies were deliberately starving the Syrians to weaken resistance to invasion or to encourage rebellion against the empire. Enver had good grounds to fear rebellion in the Syrian provinces. Ottoman losses, combined with wartime hardship, turned many Arab citizens against the Sultan's government. It fell to Jamal Pasha, as governor of Syria, to suppress the Arab threat. He hoped, by show of exemplary justice, to decapitate any Arab movement that might make common cause with the empire's enemies. He also wanted to intimidate Syrian elites from engaging in separatist politics. For, as Turkish journalist Fale Rifki surmised, the Committee of Union and Progress was the mortal enemy of all nationalists and independence movements among all of the minority communities, be they Albanian, Armenian, Greek, or Arab. In June 1915, Jamal Pasha ordered the first wave of arrests of Arab political activists. He established a military court and put the activists on trial. By August 1915, the court had completed its investigations. Jamal Pasha instructed the judges to impose the death penalty on any suspect found guilty of membership in a secret Arabist society or of conspiring with the French against the Ottoman Empire. 13 men were convicted and sentenced to death, though two of the sentences were later commuted to life imprisonment. The first hangings took place in Beirut on 21 August 1915. Ottoman soldiers sealed the central Burj Square to civilian traffic. Soldiers and policemen filled the square as the condemned men were led in the dark of night to the gallows. News of the hangings spread quickly through the Arab provinces. Word reached Jerusalem by the end of the month. "I do not know any of these patriots," İhsan Turcman wrote in his diary on 1 September, "but I was deeply shaken by this news." Turcman felt a national bond to the Arabs executed by the Turks. "Farewell to you, brave compatriots," he saluted. "May our souls meet when your noble objectives are realized." These first hangings proved but the beginning of a reign of terror. In September 1915, Jamal Pasha ordered the arrest of dozens more men implicated in the documents seized from the French consulate. They were taken to the Lebanese mountain village of Arleh, on the Beirut to Damascus highway. Between their sessions before the military tribunal, the suspects were tortured to reveal the names of other members and the aims of their societies. Those who had not yet been arrested went underground or tried to flee. Repression worked. In a matter of weeks, the Arabist movement that had confidently set the boundaries of Arab independence in the 1915 Damascus Protocol, that served as the basis of Sharif Hussein's territorial claims in the Hussein-McMahon correspondence, was broken and on the run. Damascus was a dangerous city when Sharif Hussein's son, Faisal, returned in January 1916, hoping to coordinate an uprising with the authors of the protocol. Faisal had taken precautions. He travelled with a band of 50 armed retainers that he now presented to the suspicious Ottoman authorities as the vanguard of the Hejaz volunteers. His father, Sharif Hussein, had pledged for the next Ottoman attack on the Suez Canal. Jamal Pasha welcomed Faisal and his retainers, extending to his Hashemite guests the hospitality of the governor's headquarters. On his visits to the household of the Bakris, whose son Nasib had eluded Jamal's dragnet, Faisal learned of the fate of the Arabist movement in Damascus, of the redeployment of Arab regiments away from their home provinces to the intense fighting in Gallipoli and Mesopotamia, of the civilians exiled to Anatolia with their families, and of the dozens of prominent citizens on trial before the military tribunal in Arleh, charged with treason. Faced with a transformed political situation, Faisal put aside all plans for revolt. He worked instead to build Jamal Pasha's trust and secure the release of the imprisoned Arabists. His father's deepening antagonism towards the young Turk leadership, however, undermined Faisal's efforts. The young Turk leaders pressed Sharif Hussein to contribute tribal volunteers for their next attack on the Suez Canal. Enver and Jamal took the train to Medina in February 1916 to review Hashemite forces and urge the dispatch of Mujahideen, soldiers of jihad, from Islam's holy lands. In response, the Emir wrote to Enver Pasha the following month to give his preconditions for endorsing the Sultan's jihad. Sharif Hussein's letter sounded more like the work of an Arab nationalist than a servant of the Sultan. He demanded an amnesty for all Arab political prisoners currently on trial. He called for a decentralized administration for Greater Syria, with administrative autonomy from Istanbul. And he sought hereditary rights for his family to the Emirate of Mecca, with all the traditional privileges of that office restored. Enver was brutally direct in his response. "Such matters are outside your concerns, and it will gain you nothing to persist in requesting them," he warned. He reminded the Emir of his duty to the state to provide soldiers for the war effort to be commanded by his son Faisal, who will remain the guest of the Fourth Army until the end of the war. The Sharif, unbowed by Enver's threat to hold Faisal hostage, entrusted his son to the young Turk's safekeeping, his conditions unchanged. He had, as yet, no idea how brutal the young Turks would prove against those they suspected of Arab separatist aspirations. In April 1916, the Ottoman military tribunal in Arleh concluded its deliberations. Dozens of the defendants were convicted of treasonable participation in activities of which the aims were to separate Syria, Palestine, and Iraq from the Ottoman Sultanate and to constitute them into an independent state. While everyone knew that treason carried the death penalty, many of those convicted came from prominent families and had held high office as members of parliament or in the Ottoman Senate. It seemed unthinkable that the government would hang such prominent citizens like common criminals. The Hashemites were outspoken on behalf of the Arleh convicts. Sharif Hussein addressed telegrams to the Sultan, to Jamal Pasha, and to Talat Pasha, pleading for clemency and warning against the death penalty on the grounds that blood will cry for blood. Faisal, back in Damascus, urged mercy for the Arleh convicts in his regular meetings with Jamal. Yet the young Turk leader was deaf to their arguments, determined to set an example that would deter Arab separatism once and for all. Without warning, 21 men were hanged in the pre-dawn hours of 6 May 1916 in the central squares of Beirut and Damascus. Even the Turkish journalist Faleh Rifki, who witnessed the hangings in Beirut, had sympathy and admiration for the condemned. Most of those hanged in Beirut were young nationalists, he recalled. They went from their cells to the noose, with their heads held high, singing the Arab hymn. Later that day, Rifki travelled to Damascus, where 7 men had been hanged before sunrise. He was astonished to see the notables of Damascus proceed with a banquet in Jamal Pasha's honour, 15 hours after the Arabists had faced the gallows. No mourning in Damascus, Rifki reflected. Poets, professional flatterers, orators, everyone expressed the country's gratitude to the great man who saved Arabia from its wayward children. To Arab nationalists, Jamal Pasha was no hero. In the aftermath of the hangings, they branded him Jamal Pasha al-Safar, the blood shedder. To the Hashemites, Jamal was nothing short of a murderer. Faisal was with the Bakri family when a breathless runner brought them news of the hangings. The government had printed a special issue of the official newspaper, listing the name of each of the condemned and the crimes for which he was executed. Faisal broke the shocked silence when he flung his headdress to the ground and tramped it underfoot, shouting an oath of revenge. "Death has become sweet, O Arabs!" There was no longer any reason for Faisal to remain in Damascus. Jamal's repression ruled out any political action in the Syrian provinces. Revolt was conceivable only in the Hejaz, where tribesmen outnumbered the isolated Ottoman troops. Yet before he could return to the Hejaz, Faisal needed to secure Jamal Pasha's permission to leave Damascus. On the least suspicion of disloyalty, Faisal feared he and his men could find themselves joining their martyred friends on the gallows. Faisal used a ruse to secure Jamal Pasha's permission to return to the Hejaz. The Hashemite prince claimed to have received a message from his father, confirming that the Hejaz volunteer unit was at full strength and ready to join up with Jamal's forces in Syria. The young Turks no doubt believed Sharif Hussein had been intimidated into compliance by the public hangings in Beirut and Damascus. Faisal was authorized to return to Medina to lead the Hejaz Mujahideen into Damascus in person. Jamal Pasha had not been entirely taken in by Faisal's story. Faisal had pleaded for the condemned Arabists too energetically. The commander of the Ottoman garrison in Medina had accused Sharif Ali and the Hejazi detachment of interfering in military matters. Sharif Hussein's correspondence with Enver and Jamal bordered on the treasonous. Yet the benefits of the Sharif of Mecca's endorsement for the Ottoman jihad outweighed the risks of permitting the hostage Sharif to return to the Hejaz. Sharif Faisal left Damascus on 16 May. Before he departed, Jamal Pasha presented him with a gift. Victorious Ottoman soldiers had captured the British Lee Enfield rifle, originally issued to a soldier of the 1st Essex Regiment at Gallipoli. "Booty of the Dardanelles Campaign" was inscribed on the barrel in gold letters in Ottoman Turkish. The war trophy was no doubt intended to reinforce the Hashemites' belief that the Ottomans would win the war. Yet Faisal was quick to turn the weapon against the Ottoman Empire. As a precaution against Hashemite double-dealing, Jamal decided to dispatch one of his most trusted generals, Fakhri Pasha, to take command of the garrison in Medina. Fakhri was well known for his reliability and patriotism, Jamal claimed. Others accused him of atrocities against Armenians. At the first sign of trouble, Fakhri was to seize the Sharif and his sons and put the civil affairs of Mecca under the authority of the Ottoman governor of Medina. On the eve of the Arab revolt, the Anglo-Hashemite alliance offered far less than both sides originally believed they were securing on first entering into negotiations. The British were not the invincible power they had appeared to be in early 1915, when first setting off to conquer Constantinople. The Germans had inflicted terrible casualties on the British on the Western Front, and even the Ottomans had dealt them humiliating defeats. Sharif Hussein and his sons had every reason to question their choice of ally. Yet the Hashemites were in no position to bargain. All through their correspondence with the High Commissioner in Egypt, Sharif Hussein and his sons had presented themselves as leaders of a pan-Arab movement. By May 1916, it was apparent that there would be no broader revolt in Syria and Iraq. The most the Sharifs could do was challenge Ottoman rule in the Hejaz. Success depended on their ability to mobilize the notoriously undisciplined Bedouin to their cause. Arguably, the alliance survived because the Hashemites and the British needed each other more in the summer of 1916 than ever. Sharif Hussein had strained relations with the Young Turks to the breaking point. He knew they would seize the first opportunity to dismiss, even murder, him and his sons. The British needed the Sharif's religious authority to undermine the Ottoman jihad, which officials in Cairo and Whitehall feared recent Turkish victories had strengthened. Whatever the results of a Hashemite-led revolt, the movement would at least weaken the Ottoman war effort and force the Turks to divert troops and resources to restore order in the Hejaz and possibly in other Arab provinces. For their own reasons, both the British and the Hashemites were in a hurry to launch the revolt. Once Faisal had returned to the Hejaz, they did not have long to wait. On 5 June, Faisal joined his brother Ali outside Medina to begin operations against the largest Ottoman garrison in the Hejaz. Fakhri Pasha had already arrived to take command of Ottoman forces, numbering over 11,000 men. With only the 1,500 tribal volunteers Ali had mobilized for the Sinai campaign at their disposal, the Hashemites were in no position to take the railhead. Instead, they held Fakhri Pasha's forces to Medina, leaving their father and brothers to operate with relative impunity in Mecca, some 210 miles to the south. After 4 days of skirmishes around Medina, the Hashemites made their intentions clear. Sharif Hussein's eldest son, Ali, sent an ultimatum to Jamal Pasha on 9 June, setting out a series of demands for his family's continued loyalty, the sincerity of which was undermined by the tight deadline he offered the Young Turks. 24 hours after receipt of this letter, a state of war will exist between the two nations, Turkey and the Arabs, he warned. It fell to Sharif Hussein to fire the opening shot of the Arab revolt from his palace in the holy city of Mecca. On 10 June 1916, the Emir of Mecca took up a rifle, quite possibly the same trophy from Gallipoli that Jamal had given Faisal, and fired once at the Ottoman barracks to initiate the uprising. The Hashemites were at war with the Turks in the name of the Arab peoples. It remained to be seen how the Arab world would respond. Hashemite forces secured most of Mecca within 3 days. The governor, Khalib Pasha, had withdrawn to his summer residence in the highlands of Taif, 60 miles east, and taken most of the Mecca garrison with him, leaving only 1,400 soldiers to guard the holy city. One hilltop fortress held out against the Emir's forces for 4 weeks, firing shells into Mecca to disperse the Arabs. A number of shells hit the Great Mosque, setting fire to the canopy over the Kaaba, Islam's holiest shrine. Fragments from another shell struck the name of the third caliph, Uthman ibn Affan, from the façade of the building. As the eponymous founder of the Ottoman dynasty was also named Uthman, Osman in Turkish, Sharif Hussein's son Abdullah claimed that the people of Mecca took this as an omen of the imminent fall of the Osmanla, that is, Ottoman, power. Eventually, the besieged gunners in the hilltop fort ran out of food and ammunition and were forced to surrender on 9 July, leaving Mecca in Hashemite hands. Shortly after Sharif Hussein fired his opening shot on 10 June, 4,000 Bedouin horsemen of the Harb tribe descended on the Red Sea port city of Jeddah under the command of their leader, Sharif Muhsin. The 1,500 Ottoman soldiers initially repelled the attackers with machine guns and cannon fire, dealing a heavy blow to Bedouin morale. 2 Royal Navy warships assisted the Arab attack, subjecting Ottoman positions in Jeddah to sustained cannonades. British airplanes bombed and strafed Turkish troop positions. Attacked from land, sea, and sky, the defenders surrendered on 16 June. Sharif Hussein's second son, Abdullah, had moved with a small band of 70 camel-mounted retainers to the outskirts of Taif shortly before the outbreak of the revolt. The governor, Khalib Pasha, invited Abdullah to his palace to discuss rumours of an imminent uprising. "You see how the people of Taif are leaving their homes with their children and as many of their goods as they can carry," the governor remarked. Taking a Quran from the shelf, he urged Abdullah to tell him the truth about these rumours of the revolt. Abdullah bluffed his way out of a difficult position. "Either they are not true, or it is a revolt against both you and the Sharif, or against you by the Sharif and the people. If the latter explanation were true, should I have come to you now and put myself into your hands?" When Abdullah left the governor's residence, he gave orders to his men to sever the telegraph lines and prevent any couriers from leaving Taif by road. At midnight on 10 June, he ordered his troops, reinforced by tribesmen from the surrounding countryside, to attack the Ottoman positions. "Our attack was made with great violence," he recalled. The Bedouin were quick to break through the Turkish front lines, returning with some prisoners and some loot. However, their discipline broke at sunrise, when the Turkish artillery began to fire on Arab positions. Many of the tribesmen deserted to their homes in disorder. Fearful that his forces would collapse were he to attempt further assaults, Abdullah reorganized his troops to place Taif under siege. Bedouin irregulars armed with rifles were no match for Ottoman regulars with field artillery and machine guns. After 5 weeks of stalemate, the British shipped Egyptian artillery batteries to Taif to reinforce Abdullah's position, in yet further violation of General Sir John Maxwell's 1914 promise not to involve the Egyptians in the British war effort. In mid-July, the Egyptian gunners began a sustained artillery attack that overwhelmed the Ottoman defenders. The Turks held out until 21 September, when Ghalib Pasha was forced into an unconditional surrender. The following day, the Ottoman flag was officially hauled down from the fortress and the Arab flag hoisted, Abdullah recorded. It was a very impressive sight. The Ottoman governor, shattered by the experience of siege and defeat, did not share the Hashemites' sense of history. "This is a great catastrophe," Ghalib Pasha lamented. "We were brothers, and now we are enemies." By the end of September, Sharif Hussein and his sons had captured Mecca and Taif, as well as the Red Sea ports of Jeddah, Rabigh, and Yanbu. They had taken more than 6,000 Ottoman soldiers prisoner, with relatively few casualties on either side. The following month, Sharif Hussein unilaterally declared himself King of the Arab lands, and his sons assumed the princely title Amir. The British, discomfited by the announcement, were only willing to recognize Hussein as King of the Hejaz. News of the revolt spread across the Arab world and generated growing excitement among those disillusioned by the Ottoman conduct of the war. In Jerusalem, where the Ottoman authorities suppressed news of the revolt for weeks, Isan Turcman noted the auspicious event in his diary on 10 July. "Sharif Hussein Pasha declared rebellion against the state," he wrote incredulously. "Could this be the beginning?" Turcman could not hide his enthusiasm. "Every Arab should be pleased about this news. How can we support this state after it killed our best youth? They were hanged in public squares like common criminals and gangsters. May God bless the Sharif of Hejaz and strengthen his arm, and may your campaign spread to every corner of the Arab lands until we get rid of this cursed state." Muhammad Ali el-Ajlouni was a young officer in a Syrian regiment billeted in Anatolia. In Ajlouni's experience, the war had turned Ottomans against one another. Turkish soldiers refused to mix with Arab comrades in both the mosque and the officers' mess, and made racist remarks about their skin colour, deriding Arabs as blacks. The suffering the government inflicted on innocent civilians appalled him. From his post in Tarsus on the Cilician coast, he saw trainloads of Syrians sent into exile by Jamal Pasha's administration. "We saw the pain and sorrow etched in the expression of each and every one of them," he remembered. Worse yet were the lines of Armenian deportees heading in the opposite direction, towards the Syrian desert, women, children, and the elderly, driven by guards into whose hearts mercy never found its way. Given his wartime disillusionment with the Ottoman Empire, Ajlouni was elated by news of Sharif Hussein's revolt. It restored our shaken confidence and drew broad new lines of hope and strength. It was a new dawn for the Arabs. He vowed on the spot to make his way to the Hijaz to join the revolt, whatever difficulties he might encounter. News of the Hashemite revolt ignited heated debates among Arab officers in the Ottoman army. One of Ajluni's closest friends tried to dissuade him from deserting. By allying with the Imperial British and calling for total independence from the Ottoman Empire, he argued, the Sharif's movement exposed the Arab world to European domination. Many Arabist officers preferred to remain within a reformed Ottoman Empire that gave greater autonomy to the Arab provinces. They spoke of a Turco-Arab dual monarchy on the model of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. While Ajluni considered his friend's arguments carefully, he remained committed to the Sharifian cause. Yet, as their debate demonstrated, the appeal of the Arab revolt was not universal among Arab Ottomans. The Hashemite revolt split public opinion across the broader Muslim world. The Indian Muslim press denounced the Sharif for leading the Arabs in rebellion against their caliph. Mosques in the volatile northwest frontier province of India echoed with Imam's curses against Sharif Hussein and his sons. On 27 June, the All India Muslim League passed a resolution condemning the Hashemite revolt in the strongest terms, suggesting Sharif Hussein's actions had given real cause for jihad. British officials in India, who had consistently opposed the British High Commissioner in Egypt, Sir Henry McMahon, in his negotiations with Sharif Hussein, now argued the revolt had backfired and that Indian Muslims appeared more inclined to support the Ottomans as a result. The Hashemites faced bigger problems closer to home. Initial successes left King Hussein and his sons holding towns and cities around Mecca and on the Red Sea coastline without the forces to retain them. The initial enthusiasm of their Bedouin volunteers evaporated quickly. Drawn to the revolt by the authority of the Sharif of Mecca and the opportunity to raid Ottoman government property, they had no ideological commitment to the movement for Arab independence. Once the first battles had been won and the towns taken, the tribesmen took their booty and went home. This forced King Hussein's sons to draw on every friend and favour to recruit fresh tribal soldiers with the promise of guns and regular pay that only the British could provide. In Medina, Fakhri Pasha was poised to launch a counterattack. His army was at full strength, and communications with Damascus were running smoothly. Without dynamite, the rebels had no means to cut the Hijaz railway, which continued to provision Fahri's garrison. On 1 August, a new emir of Mecca descended from the train to full state honours. The young Turks had named Sharif Ali Haider, head of a rival branch of the Hashemite dynasty, to replace the renegade Hussein on 2 July. Fahri Pasha aimed to install him in Mecca in time for the Hajj pilgrimage season in early October. There were two routes from Medina to Mecca. The inland route was more direct, but led through waterless and difficult terrain, effectively impassable to armies. The coastal route via the Red Sea ports of Yanbu and Rabigh, though much longer, was punctuated by watering holes that could sustain men on the march. To protect Mecca, the Hashemites had to control Yanbu and Rabigh. As the Ottomans set forth from Medina in early August, Faisal took up positions blocking the road to Yanbu, and his brother Ali occupied Rabigh. They were in the right locations, but needed regular soldiers, in addition to the tribal volunteers, to withstand the Ottomans. Unless they were reinforced quickly, the Hashemites faced imminent defeat, with catastrophic consequences for Arab and British interests alike. British war planners in London, Cairo, and Simla, the summer capital of British India, weighed the risks of sending British troops to reinforce the Hashemites. The government of India argued that the introduction of British troops into the Hijaz would provoke a violent reaction from Indian Muslims, who would see them as infidel soldiers desecrating the sacred soil of the Hijaz to fight the faithful legions of the caliph. The Arab Bureau in Cairo believed the Sharif's forces were on the verge of collapse, and that an Ottoman triumph in Mecca would critically discredit the British in their Muslim colonial territories. Either way, Britain's exposure in the Hijaz risked provoking jihad. The compromise position was to reinforce the Sharif's army with Muslim volunteers. The natural recruiting grounds for Muslim soldiers were the British POW camps in India and Egypt. In the course of interrogating Arab Ottoman prisoners, the British encountered many committed to the Arabist cause. Muhammad Sharif al-Faruqi, whose testimony was influential in confirming Sharif Hussein's claims to speak on behalf of a broader Arab movement, has already been mentioned. Others included the Iraqi officers Nouri al-Said and Ali Jaudat, captured in the Mesopotamia campaign, and Jafar al-Askari, taken prisoner near the Libyan frontier in the Senussi campaign. The Sharif's declaration of Arab independence was enough to convince many of these officers to disavow their loyalty to the Sultan and join the Hashemite revolt. Nouri al-Said led the first detachment from Egypt to the Hejaz on 1 August 1916. Ali Jaudat, released on parole in the city of Basra, was recruited by British officers and sent to India to persuade other POWs from the Mesopotamia campaign to sign on to the Sharif's army. Jaudat succeeded in persuading 35 officers and 350 soldiers to volunteer for the Arab revolt. They left Bombay in early September and were greeted by Nouri al-Said on arrival in Rabigh. However, not every Arab POW was committed to the Arabist cause. After these first detachments of ideologues set off, the British emptied their POW camps in Egypt and India to ship potential Arab recruits to the Hejaz campaign, with very mixed results. Two ships set off from Bombay at the end of November, carrying 90 officers and 2,100 men. When the ships arrived off Rabigh, Sharifian recruiters were dismayed to find that only 6 officers and 27 enlisted men agreed to join the Arab army. The rest either had no wish to make war on fellow Muslims or feared Turkish retribution for their treason if they were captured. After 10 days of persistent effort by Arab volunteers already in Sharifian service, the transport ships continued up the Red Sea to deposit their unwilling recruits in POW camps in Egypt. Arab officers and soldiers who abandoned Ottoman service in favour of the Sharif's cause made a contribution to the revolt that exceeded their limited numbers. Their military training and their fluency in Arabic recommended them for both training and commanding Bedouin recruits. Yet their limited numbers meant they were insufficient to hold in check the threat posed by Farid Pasha, whose army continued to advance towards Yanbu and Rabigh. As the Muslim pilgrimage season approached, Whitehall began to reconsider dispatching British troops to reinforce Hashemite positions. The British were galvanized into action when France offered to send Muslim troops to assist the campaign in the Hejaz. The French seized on the pilgrimage season to appoint an armed escort for North African pilgrims to Mecca. The escort evolved into a full-fledged military mission to the Hejaz and a French offer of assistance to the Sharif's forces. The French military mission set off alarm bells among British colonial officers. The British High Commissioner in Cairo, Sir Henry McMahon, telegraphed London to greatly deprecate the French offer of troops, as it will rob us of very great political advantages which Sharif's success will hereafter give us. In fact, the French were less interested in securing advantages in Arabia than in ensuring that the Sharifian cause did not endanger French interests in Syria. They sent officers to Arabia to keep an eye on the British and protect everything France was promised in the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Command of the French military mission fell to Colonel Edouard Bremont, who had served with distinction in Morocco and was fluent in Arabic. He arrived in Jeddah on 21 September at the head of a mixed military and civilian delegation and 200 North African pilgrims. Not to be outdone, the High Commissioner in Cairo dispatched Ronald Storrs to escort the Egyptian ceremonial delegation for the pilgrimage. It gave Storrs the opportunity to discuss military strategy both with Colonel Bremont and with Hashemite commanders in the field. All were convinced that the Sharifian forces remained too weak to hold off Farid Pasha and his Ottoman regulars. If Arab soldiers could not be recruited in sufficient numbers from British POW camps, the next best option was to deploy Muslim colonial soldiers to the Arab revolt. The British drafted Egyptian artillerymen into the Hejaz campaign, their pledge to the Egyptian people effectively abandoned under the constraints of total war. A first detachment of 250 men was sent via the Sudan. The total Egyptian contingent would reach over 960 men by December. The French military mission never exceeded British numbers, despite the large number of North African Muslim soldiers serving in the French army. When asked by Britain's War Office to contribute a Muslim artillery battery and the greatest possible number of military specialists, machine gunners, sappers, signallers, particularly those fluent in Arabic, and doctors, the French were embarrassed to admit they lacked such expertise among their Muslim soldiers. By the end of 1916, the French mission in Arabia numbered no more than 12 officers, almost entirely French, and under 100 infantrymen, almost entirely Muslim. At its height, the French force reached a total of 42 officers and 983 men, many of whom remained in Port Said without ever setting foot in Arabia. Though these colonial soldiers made an important contribution to the Arab cause, neutralizing the Ottoman advantage in artillery and machine guns, their numbers were too limited to address the looming threat of Ottoman forces from Medina, who continued their relentless advance towards the Hashemites' coastal positions across the autumn months of 1916. The Ottoman threat grew critical in early November, when the Turkish column drove Faisal and his troops from their camp in Hamra, in the hill country behind the Red Sea port of Rabigh. Without sufficient Muslim soldiers at hand, officials in Cairo and London reconsidered the pros and cons of dispatching British regulars to reinforce the Sharifian cause. The British military opposed the idea, claiming it would take more troops than they could spare to hold the Red Sea coast against Fahri Pasha's army. In London, Sir William Robertson, chief of the Imperial General Staff, suggested that 15,000 British soldiers would be required just to hold the Red Sea village of Rabigh. The military commander in Egypt, Lieutenant General Sir Archibald Murray, did not believe he could spare such numbers without putting the defence of the Suez Canal at risk. He decided to seek the advice of the one British junior officer who had met with Faisal and knew at first hand the situation at Rabigh and Yanbu. Back in Cairo, after his ill-fated attempt to assist in the relief of Major General Charles Townsend's forces in Kut, Captain T.E. Lawrence made his first visit to the Hejaz in October 1916. An intelligence officer in the Arab Bureau, he had invited himself on one of Oriental Secretary Ronald Storrs's missions to Jeddah and taken the opportunity to travel inland from Rabigh to meet with Sharif Hussein's sons and inspect their positions. The British commanders did not rate Lawrence's knowledge of military strategy, but they valued his local knowledge, and, after his travels from Rabigh to Faisal's camp in Hamra, believed he could provide crucial intelligence to help make the difficult decision about whether to send British troops to the Hejaz. In his classic History of the Arab Revolt, Lawrence provides a unique eyewitness account of Hashemite positions in the desperate autumn months of 1916. In Rabigh, he met with Ali and several Arab officers formerly in Ottoman service, Nuri al-Said of Iraq, Aziz Ali al-Misri of Egypt, and Faiz al-Hussein of Syria, who were training the Sharif's regular army units. After several days' ride on camelback, Lawrence reached Faisal's camp at Hamra. He found Faisal discouraged and his troops demoralized. They had been starved of arms, ammunition, and cash. To date, the only assistance Faisal's force had received was the battery of Egyptian artillery, whose crews expressed their resentment at having been sent so far away into the desert to serve in an unnecessary and toilsome war. He concluded that foreign soldiers, Muslim and European alike, were ill-suited for the Hejaz campaign. When asked his opinion by officials in Cairo, Lawrence warned against dispatching British troops to the Hejaz. Any expeditionary force would only rouse suspicions that the British had imperial ambitions in Arabia. If the British, with or without the approval of the Sharif, disembarked an armed force at Rabigh, powerful enough to take possession of the groves and organize a position there, the Arabs, he concluded, would, I am convinced, say, "We are betrayed," and scatter to their tents. Instead, Lawrence recommended providing Ali and Faisal with the necessary gold to retain their Bedouin soldiers' services. Nothing else would have performed the miracle of keeping a tribal army in the field for 5 months on end, Lawrence claimed. and to limit British involvement to air support and technical advisers. The British commanders found Lawrence's view that the Arabs should be left to fight the Arab revolt extremely convenient, and agreed to limit Britain's involvement accordingly. When Lawrence returned to Arabia at the start of December, the situation had deteriorated to such an extent that he must have questioned the soundness of his own advice. A Turkish surprise attack caught the Arab army unawares, and the Bedouin fighters, in Lawrence's words, melted into a loose mob of fugitives riding wildly through the night towards Yanbu. With the road to Yanbu now open before the Turkish column, Faisal had ridden in with 5,000 troops to fill the gap. He had delayed the Turkish advance, but his position was untenable. The Turks had managed to isolate Faisal's forces from his brother Ali's troops in Rabih to the south. Thus separated, neither Arab unit could withstand the Ottoman army. Once the Turks had recovered the Red Sea coast, they would face no obstacle in retaking Mecca from Sharif Hussein's forces. Lawrence rode with Faisal as he ordered his forces to retreat to the date groves of Nakhl Mubarak, just 6 hours by camel ride from Yanbu. During these manoeuvres, the Hashemite prince first suggested to Lawrence that he dress in Arab clothes so that the Arab fighters would treat him as though he were really one of the leaders, and so that he could move around the camp without his dishevelled British officer's uniform making a sensation among the tribesmen. Faisal dressed Lawrence in wedding finery given to him by an aunt, a mark of favour, no doubt, but unlikely to make the Englishman less of a sensation as he moved among the Bedouin. Faisal also gave Lawrence a rifle, the Gallipoli trophy Jamal had presented to him months earlier in Damascus. Lawrence immediately burned his initials and the date into the stock of the Lee Enfield, TEL 41216. He then left Faisal and rode back to Yanbu to sound the alarm. Back in port, Lawrence telegraphed the Royal Navy commanders in the Red Sea to warn that Yanbu was gravely threatened. Captain William Boyle promised to mobilize British ships off the port within 24 hours. Good to his word, Boyle assembled an impressive fleet of 5 warships to defend Yanbu. They were hardly ships of the line. Boyle described his own vessel, the Fox, as almost the slowest and oldest ship commanded by a captain in the Navy. But their guns were more powerful than any of the field artillery the Turks had at their disposal. As the British naval vessels assembled off Yanbu, the Turks mounted another successful attack against Faisal's forces. 3 battalions of Ottoman infantry descended on Nakhl Mubarak, supported by field artillery, and the Bedouin army collapsed into a disorderly rabble. Egyptian gunners kept up a spirited cannonade with the defective artillery the British had contributed to the Hashemite cause, old rubbish thought serviceable for the wild Arabs, in Lawrence's estimation. Without sights, rangefinders, or high explosives, the Arab artillery's chief deterrent was the noise the cannons made. It gave the Ottomans pause and the retreating Arabs courage, allowing Faisal to withdraw his forces from Nakhl Mubarak without significant casualties. They fell back onto Yanbu, completing the Arab surrender of the highlands to Ottoman forces. "Our war seemed entering its last act," Lawrence recalled. The streets of Yanbu were crowded with thousands of Arab fighters digging in for a last stand. The defenders raised earthwork walls to slow the Ottoman advance that few could have hoped would hold against a determined assault. The Royal Navy provided the only real deterrent to the Ottoman occupation of Yanbu. The vessel's imposing bulk, every gun pointing ashore, and the eerie beams of searchlights criss-crossing the plains in the dark, served as a warning against attack by day or night. By the time they reached the outskirts of Yanbu on 11 December, the Ottomans were a spent force. Though they had enjoyed a string of victories against Faisal's army, weeks of campaigning in the inhospitable Arabian highlands had taken their toll. The army's ranks had been depleted through illness, and its transport animals had been weakened by overwork and underfeeding. The soldiers fought on hostile terrain, with Bedouin tribesmen attacking the Ottomans' rear and cutting their supply lines. They could have continued chasing the Arabs, but could not afford to take on the Royal Navy. Hundreds of miles from their base in Medina, the isolated Ottoman battalions would receive no relief if they suffered serious casualties in Yanbu. They would be forced to surrender. So they turned back, Lawrence recorded, and that night, I believe, the Turks lost their war. The Ottoman army was soon driven back from Yanbu. British aircraft subjected the Turks' camp in Nurhul Mubarak to sustained aerial bombardment. Rather than suffer further attrition, they began to withdraw their forces to positions surrounding Medina. Sharif Hussein's son Abdullah pinned the Ottomans down with a force too small to lay siege to Medina, but big enough to prevent deployment beyond the limits of the town. Here, Fahri Pasha would remain for the duration of the war. Rather than risk their forces in direct assault on Ottoman defences in Medina, the Hashemites opted for a war of movement. In coordination with their British and French advisers, the Sharifian commanders planned to move north up the Red Sea coast to take the port of Wej. With the Royal Navy on hand to supply Arab forces from the Red Sea, the move would also facilitate attacks on the Hejaz Railway to sever Medina's fragile supply line. What could not be taken by conventional means might best be conquered by guerrilla methods. British war planners were relieved to see the Ottomans withdraw and leave the Hashemites in possession of their gains in the Hejaz. The Turks had been denied an important victory that would have reinforced their call for jihad by restoring Ottoman control over Mecca and the key cities of the Hejaz. The fact that the Hejaz had been stabilized without the deployment of British troops was an added bonus. Not only were Indian Muslim concerns assuaged, but the British simply had no spare forces by the end of 1916. The British had launched a major campaign against German positions on the Somme on 1 July and suffered their highest casualties in a single day, 58,000 dead and wounded. As in Verdun, the Battle of the Somme was one of attrition that dragged on for months without a decisive result. By its end in mid-November 1916, the British had suffered 420,000 casualties, and the French a further 194,000 dead and wounded. Estimates of German casualties at the Somme ranged from 465,000 to 650,000. Faced with such losses on the Western Front, the British were ever unwilling to draw down their forces in Europe for Middle Eastern battlefields. The British, spared from deploying soldiers to support Sharif Hussein in the Hejaz, were pleased to give material assistance to their Arab allies. By the end of 1916, the British government had provided nearly £1 million in gold to the Sharifian cause. They provided a flight of aircraft under British pilots, both for surveillance and to keep German-supplied Ottoman planes away from the Bedouin, who harboured an entirely healthy dread of aerial attack. Along with the French, they provided as many Muslim regular forces as they could muster, and a handful of European officers as technical advisers in such arts as railway demolition. Once the spectre of Hashemite defeat had lifted, British and French war planners came to view the Arab revolt as a distinct asset in the Great War. As early as July 1916, the War Committee had based new strategic objectives for its forces in Egypt on the strength of early Hashemite gains in Hejaz. The committee instructed the commander-in-chief in Egypt, General Murray, to establish British control along a line extending across northern Sinai from El Arish on the Mediterranean to the tiny port of Aqaba on the eastern head of the Red Sea. British war planners maintained that these measures would threaten communications between Syria and the Hejaz and encourage Syrian Arabs in support of the Arab revolt. So began the fateful link between the Hashemite revolt in Arabia and the British campaign in Palestine that, between them, would ultimately spell the downfall of the Ottoman Empire. 12. Losing ground. The fall of Baghdad, the Sinai, and Jerusalem. With the outbreak of the Arab revolt in the Hejaz, war planners on both sides of the conflict focused their attention on the Syrian lands. The Allies were intent on drawing Syria, which at that time referred to the territory of the modern states of Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, and Jordan, into a broader Arab revolt to give momentum to the Hashemite movement and to force the Ottomans to fight on hostile terrain. The Central Powers, on the other hand, were confident of their position in Syria. Aside from the first attack on the Suez Canal in February 1915, the Fourth Army had yet to see action and was at full strength. The Ottomans believed their forces in Syria were sufficient to contain the Hashemite revolt in the Hejaz and threatened British communications along the Suez Canal, which remained vulnerable to Turkish attack through the Sinai Peninsula. Although Jemal Pasha's first attack on the Suez Canal ultimately ended in failure, the Ottoman army retained control of virtually all of the Sinai Peninsula. Though the Sinai was an integral part of British-occupied Egypt, the War Cabinet was unwilling to divert the necessary troops to recover and protect the largely uninhabited Sinai Desert from future Turkish attacks. The top British priorities were to preserve stability in the Nile Valley and to maintain the flow of men and materiel through the Suez Canal. The west bank of the canal became the front line of British defence in Egypt, and the Ottomans were left undisturbed in the rest of the Sinai. By early 1916, the Ottomans had transformed the Sinai into a launching pad for sustained hostilities against British forces along the Suez Canal. Jemal Pasha, commander of the Fourth Army, had worked closely with his German advisers to reinforce Ottoman positions. He extended the railway southward from Beersheba, the small inland market town to the southeast of Gaza, to the Egyptian frontier at Al-Auja and beyond into the Sinai. The railway permitted the rapid transport of men and materiel into the heart of the Sinai. Here, Jemal established a network of bases with wells to provide water for men and animals. Roads linked the Ottoman bases, and a crack desert force patrolled the Sinai under a German commander. Jemal no longer dreamed of driving the British from Egypt as a whole. Instead, he planned to advance until his artillery was within range to strike the Suez Canal. The Ottomans could attack shipping and close the vital waterway from positions 5 miles from its banks, disrupting imperial communications without exposing their soldiers to well-entrenched British defences. When Enver Pasha inspected the Palestine frontier in February 1916, he approved Jemal's strategy and promised reinforcements. The Minister of War was true to his word. On his return to the Ottoman capital, Enver dispatched the battle-hardened 3rd Infantry Division from Gallipoli to Palestine. He also secured material support from the Central Powers. In April 1916, the Germans assigned a flight of aircraft to Ottoman headquarters in Beersheba. The state-of-the-art planes, powerful Rumplers and Fokker monoplanes that had proved the scourge of the Western Front, gave the Turks air superiority over the Sinai. Later that same month, the Austrians dispatched 2 batteries of field artillery to the Sinai front. The 15-centimetre howitzers gave Ottoman forces the firepower to challenge the British in the field. Reinforced with the latest military technology, Jemal began to plan a second attack on the Suez Canal zone in earnest. Meanwhile, the British had grown increasingly concerned by the Turkish menace to the canal zone. In February 1916, the commander of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, EEF, Lieutenant General Sir Archibald Murray, proposed an active defence based on the fortification of strategic oases and crossroads in northern Sinai. Murray's plan called for the occupation of the Katia Oasis, some 30 miles to the east of the canal. Part of a network of brackish watering holes, Katia was of critical strategic importance in the largely waterless Sinai wastes. Once Katia was secured, Murray proposed to advance along the Mediterranean coast to the port of El Arish and to occupy a line running inland from El Arish to Al-Kusayma, south of Beersheba. Murray argued persuasively that it would take far fewer men and resources to contain the Turks within the 45-mile stretch between Al-Arish and Al-Kusayma than along the full 90-mile stretch of the canal itself. The chief of the Imperial General Staff, General Sir William Robertson, saw the wisdom in denying the Sinai oases to the Turks. However, with the British facing major setbacks on the Western Front and struggling to relieve the ill-fated garrison at Kut, he was unwilling to commit to a broader campaign in Sinai or Palestine than the troops already in Egypt might safely prosecute. On 27 February 1916, Robertson authorized the occupation of Katia and the surrounding oases and deferred the decision on advancing towards El Arish to a later date. In March 1916, the British began to extend a standard-gauge railway line eastward from the canal town of Kantara towards Katia. Alongside the railway, The British also laid a pipeline to provide a reliable supply of fresh water. The 13,000 men of the Egyptian Labour Corps, working on short-term contracts, undertook the back-breaking work of building the railway and pipeline in the relentless desert heat. Following in the tracks of a caravan route, the line extended at the rate of 4 miles per week and reached the perimeter of the Katia oasis by late April. The Ottomans moved swiftly to disrupt British progress. The German commander of the Turkish Desert Force, Colonel Friedrich Freiherr Kress von Kressenstein, led 3,500 soldiers in a bold raid on British forces protecting the railhead. At dawn on 23 April, the Ottomans swept through British positions in the oases surrounding Katia. Attacking in the early morning fog, the Ottomans enjoyed total surprise, and after several hours of intense fighting, secured the surrender of nearly an entire British cavalry regiment. According to the official British account, only one officer and 80 soldiers managed to escape capture. A cavalry regiment typically numbered some 25 officers and 525 men. Von Kressenstein's force withdrew from Katia with impunity. The attack did not long disrupt progress on the railroad, but the Turks had succeeded in rattling the British, and, as Jamal Pasha recorded, it raised the confidence of our troops to a remarkable degree. Following the Ottoman attack on Katia, the British advance across northern Sinai was led by the Anzac Mounted Division. Composed of the New Zealand Mounted Brigade and units of the Australian Light Horse, the Mounted Division combined battle-seasoned Gallipoli veterans and fresh recruits. Mounted troops were essential in desert terrain inaccessible to motor vehicles. In fact, the British were forced to diversify their cavalry with camel units to give chase to Ottoman forces operating in the region's vast sand traps. The Sinai campaign thus presented a unique contrast between 20th-century air power, 19th-century cavalry tactics, and Bedouin-style camel warfare. British progress on the railway and pipeline proceeded through the intense summer heat of 1916. Workers, troops, and horses all suffered from temperatures that often exceeded 50 degrees centigrade, from shortages of potable water, and from swarms of flies that plagued man and beast alike. They took comfort in the belief that the Ottomans were unlikely to risk another attack in the midsummer heat. Yet the cavalry forces remained on high alert, patrolling deep in the desert to ensure there would be no repeat of the humiliation at Katia. After repeated delays in the long-anticipated second attack on the Suez Canal, the Ottomans and their German allies were impatient to proceed. Jamal had deferred the second Sinai campaign in the hope that Sharif Hussein would contribute a detachment of volunteers from the Hejaz. The outbreak of the Arab revolt in June 1916 dashed those hopes and created a new hostile front in the Arab provinces. Jamal believed success against the British in Sinai would undermine the appeal of the Hashemite uprising in the Arab provinces, and he gave Colonel von Kressenstein the green light to launch the long-delayed second attack on the canal zone in the dead of summer, when the British least expected it. The Turks attacked British positions at Romani, near Katia, in the early morning hours of 3 August. With only 16,000 men, Colonel von Kressenstein headed a much smaller force than the British had anticipated. In a feat of remarkable endurance, the soldiers had managed to transport artillery across the desert sands to compensate for their small numbers with heavy firepower. To catch British forces by surprise, von Kressenstein timed his advance to coincide with the return of one of the light horse patrols to base, literally tailing the Anzac cavalry home. Although they did not catch the Australians totally unawares, Ottoman forces overpowered the Anzac post and forced them into retreat, capturing strategic high ground before sunrise. Once alerted, the British flooded Romani with reinforcements to repulse the Turks. As the day wore on and the Turkish soldiers ran short of water and ammunition, hundreds were forced to surrender. Remarkably, von Kressenstein succeeded in extricating most of his forces and his heavy guns from a losing battle, driving his exhausted soldiers into a rapid retreat with Anzac cavalry in hot pursuit. The British commanders, determined to capture and destroy von Kressenstein's expeditionary corps, sent their aircraft aloft to guide the pursuers. However, the Ottomans drove back a final attack at the Bir el-Abed wells before completing their withdrawal to the safety of Al-Arish, still securely in Turkish hands. The Ottomans were soundly defeated in the Battle of Romani. They had lost an estimated 1,500 soldiers dead and wounded, and another 4,000 taken prisoner, while British losses were just over 200 killed and 900 wounded. Yet the British viewed Romani as an incomplete victory. British commanders deemed it a critical failure that von Kressenstein had been allowed to withdraw with the majority of his forces and artillery intact after suffering the type of defeat that gave ample opportunity for the destruction of his force. While Romani represented the final Ottoman attack on British positions in Egypt, the Turks still retained the forces and artillery to defend their Palestine frontier. The British advance in the Sinai in the summer of 1916 coincided with the launch of the Arab Revolt in the Hejaz. It is worth recalling that the first 2 months of the Arab Revolt were remarkably successful, with Hashemite forces defeating the Ottomans in Mecca, Taif, Jeddah, Rabigh, and Yanbu. The War Committee in London began to see the potential to coordinate the Arab Revolt and the Sinai Campaign to make the Ottoman position in southern Syria and Palestine untenable. Whereas in February 1916, the chief of the Imperial General Staff had authorized only limited operations in Katia to defend the Suez Canal, in July 1916, the War Committee ordered Murray's forces to occupy the Sinai from Al-Arish to the Red Sea port of Aqaba, since a force established at these places would directly threaten the Turkish communications between Syria and the Hejaz and encourage Syrian Arabs to revolt against the Ottomans. The methodical General Murray advanced in line with the construction of the Sinai railway and pipeline. By December 1916, the railhead had reached the wells of Mazar, within 40 miles of El Arish. With all of the necessary supplies stockpiled at the railhead and sufficient camels mobilized to deliver food, water, and ammunition to an army fighting in the barren desert, the British prepared to attack the Ottoman garrison. Ottoman commanders assessed the situation in El Arish with mounting concern. Their aerial reconnaissance had followed the British railway's progress and the concentration of troops and supplies. Moreover, they knew their garrison to be within easy range of British warships cruising off the Sinai coast. The 1,600 Ottoman defenders could not hope to hold their position against naval firepower and over 4 divisions of British infantry. On the eve of the British attack, the Ottomans fell back from El Arish to better defended positions along the Palestine frontier. The Royal Flying Corps reported Turkish lines abandoned, and on 21 December, the first British troops occupied the strategic town unopposed. The British position was far from secure. Aerial reconnaissance revealed heavily fortified Ottoman positions down the El Arish Valley in the village of Maghdaba. So long as the Turks remained in Maghdaba, they would pose a threat to the British rear. The Anzac Cavalry and Imperial Camel Brigade were dispatched to drive the Turks from Maghdaba on 23 December. It was a race against time. With no water between El Arish and Maghdaba, the mounted soldiers had to take the village before sundown. Otherwise, the parched soldiers and their mounts would be forced to withdraw to El Arish for water. By early afternoon, when their anxious commander, the Australian General Sir Harry Chauvel, was on the verge of calling off the attack, a combined cavalry and camel assault broke through Ottoman lines. To our surprise, a camelier, a soldier of the Camel Corps, recalled, several of the Turks jumped from their trenches to shake hands with us. It was a strange moment of fraternizing between men who had last met in the Dardanelles. "Put it there, old chap," an Australian private said to a Turkish prisoner wearing a Gallipoli campaign medal. "I was there myself, and it was such a hell of a place that you have my sympathy." The Australian then pinned the Turkish medal on his own chest and helped himself to the prisoner's tobacco before advancing on another Ottoman position. Nearly 1,300 Ottoman soldiers surrendered as the British completed their occupation of the El Arish Valley. The British completed the reconquest of the Sinai on 9 January 1917 with the capture of the town of Rafah on the Ottoman-Egyptian frontier. In a day of intense fighting, forces of the Anzac Mounted Division succeeded in encircling the Ottoman trenches and forcing their surrender. Following their retreat from Rafah, the Ottomans abandoned their ambitions in Egypt to protect their position in Palestine. A question mark hung over the ultimate objective of the EEF. A new British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, came to office in December 1916 following a cabinet crisis over the conduct of the war. A liberal, like his predecessor, H.H. Asquith, heading a coalition government with the Conservatives, Lloyd George sought a quick and decisive victory that would rally the government and the public behind his leadership. He argued for a vigorous campaign against the Ottomans in Palestine, convinced the conquest of Jerusalem would give British public opinion a much-needed boost after the ghastly losses at Verdun and the Somme. Lloyd George's generals, on the other hand, were loath to deploy more troops outside the Western Front, where they knew the war would be won or lost. The primary mission of the EEF, the generals argued, was the defence of Egypt. The military men won the argument, and 2 days after the EEF's victory in Rafah, the War Cabinet ordered General Murray to defer large-scale operations in Palestine until the autumn of 1917, and to dispatch one division of his forces to France. Expelled from Sinai, the Ottomans established a defensive line running inland from Gaza on the coast to the oasis town of Beersheba. Between January and March 1917, Ottoman reinforcements were deployed to the 20-mile front protecting southern Palestine. A cavalry unit from the Caucasus and an infantry division from Thrace joined Jamal's forces in a determined bid to preserve Palestine from a future British attack. At the start of 1917, as the EEF ground to a halt on the Palestine frontier, the Mesopotamian Expeditionary Force, MEF, resumed its offensive on the Tigris. What began as a cautious advance designed to wear down the Ottoman Sixth Army ended in the first major British victory in the Middle East, the conquest of Baghdad. Repeated assaults to relieve Kut had left both British and Ottoman forces depleted and exhausted by the time Major General Charles Townshend surrendered in April 1916. Having failed in their objective, the British had neither the forces nor the incentive to resume their attack on Ottoman lines on the Tigris, and the Turks themselves were too worn down to take the offensive against the weakened British forces. Both sides reinforced their positions, tended to their sick and wounded, and lapsed into relative inactivity, while their respective higher commands were preoccupied with more critical threats on other fronts. Almost immediately after their victory in Kut, the Ottomans faced the menace of a Russian attack on Baghdad. In early May 1916, General Nikolai Baratov, commander-in-chief of the Russian armies in Persia, occupied the border town of Kasr-i-Shirin and threatened Turkish positions across the front in Hanekin, just 100 miles from Baghdad. Halil Pasha, who had been rewarded for his victory in Kut with command over the Ottoman Sixth Army, redeployed his forces from the Tigris front for the defence of Hanekin, reducing his numbers around Kut to 12,000 men. The British made Halil's task easier. Sir William Robertson, the chief of the Imperial General Staff, confirmed British aims in Mesopotamia after the fall of Kut as defensive, and he informed the MEF commander, "We do not attach any importance to the possession of Kut or to the occupation of Baghdad." He recommended the British maintain as forward a position as can be made secure tactically, to minimize the effect of the fall of Kut on Britain's reputation, and to force the Ottomans to retain troops on the Tigris that might otherwise be redeployed to confront the Russian column threatening Baghdad. But Robertson had no intention of authorizing hostilities against Ottoman positions on the Tigris. With the British taking a passive line, Halil threw everything he had at the Russians and stopped Baratov at Hanekin on 1 June 1916, driving Russian forces back in a bid to occupy the Persian towns of Kermanshah, 1 July, and Hamdan, 10 August. The Ottoman surge into Persia worried both the Russians and the British, but left Halil Pasha's defences in Baghdad dangerously understrength. They never recovered, and would leave Halil struggling to contain the British threat, as reinforcements began to arrive in Mesopotamia from India and Egypt. In August, the British appointed a new commander to the MEF. Major General Sir Stanley Maude had been wounded in France and was the last